8. Holly has a fresh box of Nicorette by her telephone but doesn't need to use a single chew. The first Alderson she calls turns out to be the housekeeper's sister-in-law, who of course wants to know why someone from a company called Finders Keepers wants to get in touch with Nan. "Is it a bequest or something?" she asks hopefully. "One moment," Holly says. "I have to put you on hold while I get my boss." Hodges is not her boss. He made her a full partner after the Pete Saubers business last year, but it's a fiction she often falls back on when she's stressed. Hodges, who has been using his own computer to read up on Zappit game systems, picks up the phone while Holly lingers by his desk, gnawing at the neck of her sweater. Hodges hovers his finger over the hold button on his phone long enough to tell Holly that eating wool probably isn't good for her, and certainly not for the fair isle she's wearing. Then he connects with the sister-in-law. "I'm afraid I have some bad news for Nancy," he says, and fills her in quickly.
"Oh, my God," Linda Alderson says. Holly has jotted the name on his pad. "She's going to be devastated to hear that, and not just because it means the end of the job. She's been working for those ladies since 2012, and she really likes them. She had Thanksgiving dinner with them just last November. Are you with the police?"
"Retired," he says, "but working with the team assigned to the case. I was asked to get in touch with Ms. Alderson." He doesn't think this lie will come back to haunt him since Pete opened the door by inviting him to the scene. "Can you tell me how to get in touch with her?"
"I'll give you her cell number. She went to Chagrin Falls for her brother's birthday party on Saturday. It was the big 4-0, so Harry's wife made a fuss about it. She's staying until Wednesday or Thursday, I think. At least that was the plan. I'm sure this news will bring her back. Nan lives alone since Bill died. Bill was my husband's brother, with only her cat for company. Mrs. Ellerton and Ms. Stover were sort of a surrogate family. This will just make her so sad."
Hodges takes the number down and calls immediately. Nancy Alderson picks up on the first ring. He identifies himself, then gives her the news. After a moment of shocked silence, she says, "Oh no, that can't be. You've made a mistake, Detective Hodges." He doesn't bother to correct her, because this is interesting.
"Why do you say that?"
"Because they're happy. They get along so well, watching TV together. They love movies on the DVD player, and those shows about cooking, or where women sit around talking about fun things and having celebrity guests. You wouldn't believe it, but there's a lot of laughter in that house."
Nancy Alderson hesitates, then says,
"Are you sure you're talking about the right people? About Jan Ellerton and Marty Stover?"
"Sorry to say I am."
"But she had accepted her condition. Marty, I'm talking about, Martine. She used to say that getting used to being paralyzed was actually easier than getting used to being a spinster. She and I used to talk about that all the time, being on our own, because I lost my husband, you know."
"So there was never a Mr. Stover?"
"Yes, there was. Janice had an earlier marriage. Very short, I believe, but she said she never regretted it because she got Martine. Marty did have a boyfriend not long before her accident, but he had a heart attack. Carried him right off. Marty said he was very fit, used to exercise 3 days a week at a health club downtown. She said it was being so fit that killed him, because his heart was strong, and when it backfired, it just blew apart."
Hodges, a coronary survivor, thinks, "Reminder to self, no fitness club."
"Marty used to say that being alone after someone you love passes on was the worst kind of paralysis. I didn't feel exactly the same way about my Bill, but I knew what she meant. Reverend Henried came in to see her often. Marty calls him her spiritual advisor. And even when he didn't, she and Jan did daily devotions and prayers, every day at noon. And Marty was thinking about taking an accounting course online. They have special courses for people with her kind of disability. Did you know that?"
"I didn't," Hodges says. On his pad he prints, "Stover planning to take accounting course by computer," and turns it so Holly can read it. She raises her eyebrows.
"There were tears and sadness from time to time, of course there was, but for the most part they were happy. At least, I don't know."
"What are you thinking about, Nancy?" He makes the switch to her first name, another old cop trick, without thinking about it.
"Oh, it's probably nothing. Marty seemed as happy as ever. She's a real love bug, that one. You wouldn't believe how spiritual she is. Always sees the good side of everything. But Jan did seem a little withdrawn lately, as if she had something weighing on her mind. I thought it might be money worries, or maybe just the after-Christmas blues. I never dreamed.
She sniffles.
Excuse me, I have to blow.
Sure. Holly grabs his pad. Her printing is small. Constipated, he often thinks, and he has to hold the pad almost touching his nose to read, "Ask her about Zappit." There's a honking sound in his ear as Alderson blows her nose.
Sorry.
That's all right, Nancy. Would you know if Mrs. Ellerton happened to have a small handheld game console? It would have been pink.
Goodness sakes, how did you know that?
I really don't know anything, Hodges says truthfully. I'm just a retired detective with a list of questions I'm supposed to ask.
She said a man gave it to her. He told her the game gadget was free as long as she promised to fill out a questionnaire and send it back to the company. The thing was a little bit bigger than a paperback book. It just sat around the house a while.
When was this?
I can't remember exactly, but before Christmas for sure. The first time I saw it, it was on the coffee table in the living room. It just stayed there with the questionnaire folded up beside it until after Christmas. I know because their little tree was gone. And then I spied it one day on the kitchen table. Jan said she'd turned it on just to see what it would do, and found out there were solitaire games on it, maybe as many as a dozen different kinds, like Klondike and Picture and Pyramid. So since she was using it, she filled out the questionnaire and sent it in.
Did she charge it in Marty's bathroom?
Yes, because that was the most convenient place. She was in that part of the house so much, you know.
Uh-huh. You said that Mrs. Ellerton became withdrawn.
A little withdrawn,
Alderson corrects at once.
Mostly she was the same as always. A love bug, just like Marty.
But something was on her mind.
Yes, I think so.
Weighing on her mind.
Well,
was this around the same time she got the handheld game machine?
I guess it was, now that I think about it. But why in the world would playing solitaire on a little pink tablet depress her?
I don't know, Hodges says and prints depressed on his pad. He thinks there's a significant jump between being withdrawn and being depressed.
Have their relations been told?
Alderson asks.
There aren't any in the city, but there are cousins in Ohio, I know that. And I think some in Kansas, too. Or maybe it was Indiana. The names would be in her address book.
The police will be doing that as we speak, Hodges says, although he will call Pete later on to make sure. It will probably annoy his old partner, but Hodges doesn't care. Nancy Alderson's distress is in every word she utters, and he wants to offer what comfort he can. May I ask one more question?
Of course.
Did you happen to notice anyone hanging around the house, anyone without an obvious reason to be there? Holly is nodding vigorously.
Why would you ask that?
Alderson sounds astonished.
Surely you don't think some outsider...
I don't think anything, Hodges says smoothly. I'm just helping the police because there's been such a staff reduction in the last few years. Citywide budget cuts.
I know. It's awful.
So they gave me this list of questions, and that's the last one.
Well, there was nobody. I'd have noticed because of the breezeway between the house and the garage. The garage is heated, so that's where the pantry and the washer-dryer are. I'm back and forth in that breezeway all the time, and I can see the street from there. Hardly anyone comes all the way up Hilltop Court because Jan and Marty's is the last house. It's just the turnaround after that. Of course, there's the postman and UPS and sometimes FedEx, but otherwise, unless someone gets lost, we've got that end of the street to ourselves.
So there was no one at all?
No, sir, there sure wasn't.
Not the man who gave Mrs. Ellerton the game console?
No. He approached her in Ridgeline Foods. That's the grocery store at the foot of the hill down where City Avenue crosses Hilltop Court. There's a Kroger about a mile further on in the City Avenue Plaza, but Janice won't go there even though things are a little cheaper, because she says you should always buy locally if you... You...
She gives a sudden loud sob.
But she's done shopping anywhere, isn't she? Oh, I can't believe this. Jan would never hurt Marty, not for the world.
It's a sad thing, Hodges says.
I'll have to come back today.
Alderson now talking to herself rather than to Hodges.
It may take a while for her relatives to come, and someone will have to make the proper arrangements.
A final housekeeping duty, Hodges thinks, and finds the thought both touching and obscurely horrible. I want to thank you for your time, Nancy. I'll let you go now.
Of course there was that elderly fellow,
Alderson says. What elderly fellow was that?
I saw him several times outside 1588. He'd park at the curb and just stand on the sidewalk, looking at it. That's the house across the street and down the hill a little way. You might not have noticed it, but it was for sale.
Hodges did notice, but doesn't say so. He doesn't want to interrupt.
Once, he walked right up the lawn to look in the bay window. This was before the last big snowstorm. I think he was window shopping.
She gives a watery laugh.
Although my mother would have called it window wishing, because he surely didn't look like the sort who could afford a house like that.
No?
Uh-uh. He was dressed in workman's clothes. You know, green pants like Dickie's. And his parka was mended with a piece of masking tape. Also, his car looked very old and had spots of primer on it. My late husband used to call that poor man's polish.
You don't happen to know what kind of car it was, do you? He flips his pad to a fresh sheet and writes, "Fine date of last big snowstorm." Holly reads it and nods.
No, I'm sorry. I don't know cars. I don't even remember the color, just those spots of primer paint. Mr. Hodges, are you sure there hasn't been some mistake?
She's almost begging. I wish I could tell you that, Nancy, but I can't. You've been very helpful. Doubtfully.
Have I?
Hodges gives her his number, Holly's, and the office number. He tells her to call if anything occurs to her that they haven't covered. He reminds her that there may be press interest because Martine was paralyzed at City Center in 2009, and tells her she isn't obliged to talk to reporters or TV news people if she doesn't want to. Nancy Alderson is crying again when he breaks the connection. 9. He takes Holly to lunch at Panda Garden, a block down the street. It's early, and they have the dining room almost to themselves. Holly is off meat and orders vegetable chow mein. Hodges loves the spicy shredded beef, but his stomach won't put up with it these days, so he settles for ma la lamb. They both use chopsticks. Holly, because she's good with them, and Hodges, because they slow him down and make a post-lunch bonfire in his guts less likely.
She says, "The last big storm was December 19th. The Weather Service reported 11 inches in Government Square, 13 in Branson Park. Not exactly huge, but the only other one so far this winter dropped just 4 inches.
6 days before Christmas. Around the same time Janice Ellerton was given the zappet, according to Alderson's recollection.
Do you think the man who gave it to her was the same one looking at that house?
Hodges snares a piece of broccoli. It's supposed to be good for you, like all veggies that taste bad. I don't think Ellerton would have accepted anything from a guy wearing a parka mended with masking tape. I'm not counting the possibility out, but it seems unlikely.
Eat your lunch, Bill. If I get any further ahead of you, I'll look like a pig.
Hodges eats, although he has very little appetite these days, even when his stomach isn't giving him the devil. When a bite sticks in his throat, he washes it down with tea. Maybe a good idea, since tea seems to help. He thinks about those test results he has yet to see. It occurs to him that his problem could be worse than an ulcer, that an ulcer might actually be the best-case scenario. There's medicine for ulcers. Other things, not so much. When he can see the middle of his plate, but Jesus, so much food left around the edges, he sets his chopsticks aside and says, "I found something out while you were hunting down Nancy Alderson."
"Tell me."
"I was reading about those zappets. Amazing how these computer-based companies pop up then disappear. They're like dandelions in June. The commander didn't exactly corner the market. Too simple, too expensive, too much sophisticated competition. Zappet Inc. stock went down, and they got bought out by a company called Sunrise Solutions. 2 years ago, that company declared bankruptcy and went dark, which means Zappet is long gone, and the guy giving out Commander consoles had to be running some kind of scam."
Holly is quick to see where that leads. "So the questionnaire was bullpoop, just to add a little, what do you call it, verisimilitude. But the guy didn't try to get money out of her, did he?
No, at least not that we know of.
Something weird is going on here, Bill. Are you going to tell Detective Huntley and Miss Pretty Gray Eyes?
Hodges has picked up the smallest piece of lamb left on his plate, and here is an excuse to drop it. Why don't you like her, Holly?
Well, she thinks I'm crazy,
Holly says matter-of-factly.
There's that.
I'm sure she doesn't.
Yes, she does. She probably thinks I'm dangerous, too, because of the way I whopped Brady Hartsfield at the Round Here concert. But I don't care. I'd do it again, 1,000 times.
He puts a hand over hers. The chopsticks she's holding in her fist vibrate like a tuning fork. I know you would, and you'd be right every time. You saved 1,000 lives, and that's a conservative estimate.
She slides her hand from beneath his and starts picking up grains of rice. Oh, I can deal with her thinking I'm crazy. I've been dealing with people thinking that all my life, starting with my parents. But there's something else. Isabel only sees what she sees, and she doesn't like people who see more, or at least look for more. She feels the same way about you, Bill. She's jealous of you, over Pete.
Hodges says nothing. He's never considered such a possibility. She puts down her chopsticks.
You didn't answer my question. Are you going to tell them what we've learned so far?
Not quite yet. There's something I want to do first, if you'll hold down the office this afternoon.
Holly smiles down at the remainder of her chow mein. I always do.
10. Bill Hodges isn't the only one who took an instant dislike to Becky Helmington's replacement. The nurses and orderlies who work in the traumatic brain injury clinic call it the bucket, as in brain bucket. And before long, Ruth Scapelli has become known as Nurse Ratchet. By the end of her 3rd month, she has gotten 3 nurses transferred for various small infractions and 1 orderly fired for smoking in a supply closet. She has banned certain colorful uniforms as too distracting or too suggestive. The doctors like her, though. They find her swift and competent. With the patients, she is also swift and competent. But she's cold, and there's an undertone of contempt there as well. She will not allow even the most cataclysmically injured of them to be called a gork or a burn or a wipeout, at least not in her hearing. But she has a certain attitude.
She knows her stuff, one nurse said to another in the break room not long after Scapelli took up her duties. No argument about that, but there's something missing. The other nurse was a 30-year veteran who had seen it all. She considered, then said 1 word, but it was le mot juste. Mercy. Scapelli never exhibits coldness or contempt when she accompanies Felix Babineau, the head of neuro, on his rounds, and he probably wouldn't notice if she did. Some of the other doctors have noticed, but few pay any mind. The doings of such lesser beings as nurses, even head nurses, are far below their lordly gaze. It is as if Scapelli feels that, no matter what is wrong with them, the patients of the traumatic brain injury clinic must bear part of the responsibility for their current condition, and if they only tried harder, they would surely regain at least some of their faculties. She does her job, though, and for the most part she does it well, perhaps better than Becky Helmington, who was far better liked. If told this, Scapelli would have said, she was not here to be liked. She was here to care for her patients, end of story, full stop. There is, however, 1 long-term patient in the bucket whom she hates. That patient is Brady Hartsfield. It isn't because she had a friend or relative who was hurt or killed at City Center. It's because she thinks he's shamming, avoiding the punishment he so richly deserves. Mostly she stays away and lets other staff members deal with him, because just seeing him often infuses her with a day-long rage that the system should be so easily gamed by this vile creature. She stays away for another reason, too. She doesn't entirely trust herself when she's in his room. On 2 occasions, she has done something. The kind of thing that, were it discovered, might result in her being the one fired. But on this early January afternoon, just as Hodges and Holly are finishing their lunch, she is drawn down to room 217
as if by an invisible cable.
Only this morning she was forced to go in there because Dr. Babineau insists she accompany him on rounds and Brady is his star patient. He marvels at how far Brady has come.
He should never have emerged from his coma at all, Babineau told her shortly after she came on staff at the bucket.
He's a cold fish, but when he speaks of Brady, he becomes almost jolly.
And look at him now. He's able to walk short distances, with help, I grant you. He can feed himself, and he can respond either verbally or with signs to simple questions.
He's also prone to poking himself in the eye with his fork, Ruth Scapelli could have added, but doesn't. And his verbal responses all sound like wah-wah and gub-gub to her. Then there's the matter of waste. Put a depends on him, and he holds it. Take it off, and he urinates in his bed, regular as clockwork. Defecates in it if he can. It's as if he knows. She believes he does know. Something else he knows, of this there can be no doubt, is that Scapelli doesn't like him. This very morning, after the exam was finished and Dr. Babineau was washing his hands in the ensuite bathroom, Brady raised his head to look at her and lifted one hand to his chest. He curled it into a loose, trembling fist. From it, his middle finger slowly extended. At first, Scapelli could barely comprehend what she was seeing. Brady Hartsfield giving her the finger. Then, as she heard the water go off in the bathroom, two buttons popped from the front of her uniform, exposing the center of her sturdy Playtex 18-hour comfort strap bra. She doesn't believe the rumors she's heard about this waste of humanity, refuses to believe them. But then he smiled at her, grinned at her. Now, she walks down to room 217 while soothing music wafts from the speakers overhead. She's wearing her spare uniform, the pink one she keeps in her locker and doesn't like much. She looks both ways to make sure no one is paying any attention to her, pretends to study Brady's chart just in case there's a set of prying eyes she's missed, and slips inside. Brady sits in his chair by the window where he always sits. He's dressed in one of his four plaid shirts and a pair of jeans. His hair has been combed, and his cheeks are baby smooth. A button on his breast pocket proclaims, "I was shaved by Nurse Barbara." He's living like Donald Trump, Ruth Scapelli thinks. He killed 8 people and wounded God knows how many more. He tried to kill thousands of teenage girls at a rock and roll concert. And here he sits with his meals brought to him by his own personal staff, his clothes laundered, his face shaved. He gets a massage 3 times a week. He visits the spa 4 times a week and spends time in the hot tub. Living like Donald Trump, more like a desert chieftain in one of those oil-rich Mideast countries. And if she told Babineau that he gave her the finger? Oh, no, he'd say. Oh, no, Nurse Scapelli. What you saw was nothing but an involuntary muscle twitch. He's still incapable of the thought processes that would lead to such a gesture. Even if that were not the case, why would he make such a gesture to you? Because you don't like me, she says, bending forward with her hands on her pink-skirted knees. Do you, Mr. Hartsfield? And that makes us even, because I don't like you.
He doesn't look at her or give any sign that he's heard her. He only looks out the window at the parking garage across the way. But he does hear her. She's sure he does. And his failure to acknowledge her in any way infuriates her more. When she talks, people are supposed to listen.
Am I to believe you popped the buttons on my uniform this morning by some kind of mind control?
Nothing.
I know better. I'd been meaning to replace that one. The bodice was a bit too tight. You may fool some of the more credulous staff members, but you don't fool me, Mr. Hartsfield. All you can do is sit there and make a mess in your bed every time you get the chance.
Nothing. She glances around at the door to make sure it's shut, then removes her left hand from her knee and reaches out with it.
All those people you hurt, some of them still suffering, does that make you happy? It does, doesn't it? How would you like it? Shall we find out? She first touches the soft ridge of a nipple beneath his shirt, then grasps it between her thumb and index finger. Her nails are short, but she digs in with what she has. She twists first one way, then the other. That's pain, Mr. Hartsfield. Do you like it? His face remains as bland as ever, which makes her angrier still. She bends closer until their noses are almost touching, her face more like a fist than ever. Her blue eyes bulge behind her glasses. There are tiny spit buds at the corners of her lips. I could do this to your testicles, she whispers. Perhaps I will. Yes, she just might. It's not as if he can tell Babineau, after all. He has 4 dozen words at most, and few people can understand what he does manage to say. I want more corn comes out, Awanmako, which sounds like fake Indian talk in an old Western movie. The only thing he says that's perfectly clear is, I want my mother. And on several occasions, Scapelli has taken great pleasure in re-informing him that his mother's dead. She twists his nipple back and forth, clockwise and counterclockwise, pinching as hard as she can, and her hands are nurse's hands, which means they are strong. You think Dr. Babineau is your pet, but you've got that backwards. You're his pet. His pet guinea pig. He thinks I don't know about the experimental drugs he's been giving you, but I do. Vitamins, he says. Vitamins, my fanny. I know everything that goes on around here. He thinks he's going to bring you all the way back, but that will never happen. You're too far gone. And what if it did? You'd stand trial and go to jail for the rest of your life. And they don't have hot tubs in Waynesville State Prison. She's pinching his nipple so hard the tendons on her wrist stand out, and he still shows no sign that he feels anything. Just looks out at the parking garage, his face a blank. If she keeps on, one of the nurses is apt to see bruising swelling and it will go on his chart. She lets go and steps back, breathing hard, and the Venetian blind at the top of his window gives an abrupt bone-like rattle. The sound makes her jump and look around. When she turns back to him, Hartsfield is no longer looking at the parking garage. He's looking at her. His eyes are clear and aware. Scapelli feels a bright spark of fear and takes a step back. I could report Babineau, she says, but doctors have a way of wiggling out of things, especially when it's their word against a nurse's, even a head nurse's. And why would I? Let him experiment on you all he wants. Even Waynesville is too good for you, Mr. Hartsfield. Maybe he'll give you something that will kill you. That's what you deserve. A food trolley rumbles by in the corridor. Someone is getting a late lunch. Ruth Scapelli jerks like a woman awaking from a dream and backs toward the door, looking from Hartsfield to the now silent Venetian blind and then back to Hartsfield again. I'll leave you to your thoughts, but I want to tell you one more thing before I go. If you ever show me your middle finger again, it will be your testicles. Brady's hand rises from his lap to his chest. It trembles, but that's a motor control issue. Thanks to 10 sessions a week downstairs in physical therapy, he's gotten at least some muscle tone back. Scapelli stares, unbelieving, as the middle finger rises and tilts toward her. With it comes that obscene grin. You're a freak, she says in a low voice. An aberration. But she doesn't approach him again. She's suddenly, irrationally afraid of what might happen if she did.
11. Tom Saubers is more than willing to do the favor Hodges has asked of him, even though it means rescheduling a couple of afternoon appointments. He owes Bill Hodges a lot more than a tour through an empty house up in Ridgedale. After all, the ex-cop, with the help of his friends Holly and Jerome, saved the lives of his son and daughter, possibly his wife's as well. He punches off the alarm in the foyer, reading the numbers from a slip of paper clipped to the folder he carries. As he leads Hodges through the downstairs rooms, their footfalls echoing, Tom can't help going into his spiel. Yes, it's quite a long way out from the city center. Can't argue the point. But what that means is you get all the city services, water, plowing, garbage removal, school buses, municipal buses, without all the city noise. The place is cable-ready and way above code, he says.
Great, but I don't want to buy it.
Tom looks at him curiously.
What do you want?
Hodges sees no reason not to tell him.
To know if anyone has been using it to keep an eye on that house across the street. There was a murder-suicide there this past weekend.
In 1601? Jesus, Bill, that's awful.
It is, Hodges thinks, and I believe you're already wondering who you should talk to about becoming the selling agent on that one. Not that he holds that against the man who went through his own hell as a result of the city center massacre.
See, you've left the cane behind, Hodges comments as they climb to the second floor. I sometimes use it at night, especially if the weather's rainy, Tom says. The scientists claim that stuff about your joints hurting more in wet weather is bullshit, but I'm here to tell you that's one old wives' tale you can take to the bank. Now, this is the master bedroom, and you can see how it's set up to catch the morning light. The bathroom is nice and big. The shower has pulsing jets. And just down the hall here?
Yes, it's a fine house. Hodges would expect nothing else here in Ridgedale, but there's no sign anyone has been in it lately.
Seen enough? Tom asks.
I think so, yes. Did you notice anything out of place?
Not a thing. And the alarm is a good one. If someone had broken in...
Yeah, Hodges says. Sorry to get you out on such a cold day.
Nonsense. I had to be out and about anyway. And it's good to see you. They step out the kitchen door, which Tom relocks. Although you're looking awfully thin.
Well, you know what they say. You can't be too thin or too rich.
Tom, who in the wake of his city center injuries was too thin and too poor, gives this oldie an obligatory smile and starts around to the front of the house. Hodges follows a few steps, then stops.
Could we look in the garage?
Sure, but there's nothing in there.
Just a peek.
Cross every T and dot every I, huh? Roger that. Just let me get the right key.
Only he doesn't need the key because the garage door is standing 2 inches ajar. The two men look at the splinters around the lock silently.
At last, Tom says, Well, how about that?
The alarm system doesn't cover the garage, I take it.
You take it right. There's nothing to protect.
Hodges steps into a rectangle with bare wood walls and a poured concrete floor. There are boot prints visible on the concrete. Hodges can see his breath, and he can see something else as well. In front of the left overhead door is a chair. Someone sat here, looking out. Hodges has been feeling a growing discomfort on the left side of his midsection, one that's putting out tentacles that curl around to his lower back, but this sort of pain is almost an old friend by now, and it's temporarily overshadowed by excitement. Someone sat here looking out at 1601, he thinks. I'd bet the farm on it, if I had a farm. He walks to the front of the garage and sits where the watcher sat. There are three windows running horizontally across the middle of the door, and the one on the far right has been wiped clean of dust. The view is a straight shot to the big living room window of 1601.
Hey, Bill, Tom says. Something under the chair.
Hodges bends to look, although doing so turns up the heat in his gut. What he sees is a black disc, maybe 3 inches across. He picks it up by the edges. Embossed on it in gold is a single word, Steiner.
Is it from a camera? Tom asks.
From a pair of binoculars. Police departments with fat budgets use Steiner binocs. With a good pair of Steiners, and as far as Hodges knows, there's no such thing as a bad pair, the watcher could have put himself right into the Ellerton Stover living room, assuming the blinds were up. And they had been when he and Holly were in that room this morning. Hell, if the woman had been watching CNN, the watcher could have read the news crawl at the bottom of the screen. Hodges doesn't have an evidence baggie, but there's a travel-sized pack of Kleenex in his coat pocket.
He takes out two, carefully wraps the lens cap, and slips it into the inside pocket of his coat. He rises from the chair, provoking another twinge. The pain is bad this afternoon. Then spies something else. Someone has carved a single letter into the wood upright between the two overhead doors, perhaps using a pocket knife. It's the letter Z. 12. They are almost back to the driveway when Hodges is visited by something new. A searing bolt of agony behind his left knee. It feels as if he's been stabbed. He cries out, as much in surprise as from the pain, and bends over, kneading at the throbbing knot, trying to make it let go, to loosen up a little at least. Tom bends down next to him, and thus neither of them sees the elderly Chevrolet cruising slowly along Hilltop Court. Its fading blue paint is dappled with spots of red primer. The old gent behind the wheel slows down even more so he can stare at the two men. Then the Chevrolet speeds up, sending a puff of blue exhaust from its tailpipe, and passes the Ellerton Stover house headed for the button-hook turnaround at the end of the street. "What is it?" Tom asks. "What happened?" "Cramp," Hodges says through gritted teeth. "Rub it." Hodges gives him a look of pained humor through his tumbled hair. "What do you think I'm doing?" "Let me." Tom Saubers, a physical therapy veteran thanks to his attendance at a certain job fair 6 years ago, pushes Hodges' hand aside. He removes one of his gloves and digs in with his fingers hard.
"Ow, Jesus, that fucking hurts."
"I know," Tom says. "Can't be helped. Move as much of your weight to your good leg as you can." Hodges does so. The Malibu, with its patches of dull red primer paint, cruises slowly by once more, this time headed back down the hill. The driver helps himself to another long look, then speeds up again.
"It's letting go," Hodges says. "Thank God for small favors."
It is, but his stomach is on fire, and his lower back feels like he wrenched it. Tom is looking at him with concern.
"You sure you're all right?"
"Yeah, just a Charlie horse."
"Or maybe a deep vein thrombosis. You're no kid anymore, Bill. You ought to get that checked out. If anything happened to you while you were with me, Pete would never forgive me. His sister, either. We owe you a lot."
"All taken care of. Got a doctor's appointment tomorrow," Hodges says. "Come on, let's get out of here. It's freezing."
He limps the first two or three steps, but then the pain behind his knee lets go entirely and he's able to walk normally. More normally than Tom. Thanks to his encounter with Brady Hartsfield in April of 2009, Tom Saubers will limp for the rest of his life. 13. When Hodges gets home, his stomach is better, but he's dog-tired. He tires easily these days and tells himself it's because his appetite has gotten so lousy, but he wonders if that's really it. He's heard the pain of breaking glass and the boys giving their home run cheer twice on his way back from Ridgedale, but he never looks at his phone while driving, partly because it's dangerous, not to mention illegal in this state, mostly because he refuses to become a slave to it. Besides, he doesn't need to be a mind reader to know from whom at least one of those texts came. He waits until he's hung his coat in the front hall closet, briefly touching the inside pocket to make sure the lens cap is still safe and sound. The first text is from Holly.
"We should talk to Pete and Isabel, but call me first. I have a cue."
The other isn't hers. It reads, "Dr. Stamos needs to talk to you urgently. You are scheduled tomorrow at 9 a.m. Please keep this appointment." Hodges checks his watch and sees that although the stay seems to have lasted at least a month already, it's only 4:15. He calls Stamos's office and gets Marley. He can tell it's her by the chirpy cheerleader's voice, which turns grave when he introduces himself. He doesn't know what those tests showed, but it can't be good. As Bob Dylan once said, you don't need a weatherman to know which way the wind blows. He bargains for 9:30 instead of 9 because he wants a sit-down with Holly, Pete, and Isabel first. He won't allow himself to believe that his visit to Dr. Stamos's office may be followed by a hospital admission, but he is a realist, and that sudden bolt of pain in his leg scared the shit out of him. Marley puts him on hold. Hodges listens to the young rascals for a while. They must be mighty old rascals by now, he thinks. And then she comes back.
We can get you in at 9:30, Mr. Hodges, but Dr. Stamos wants me to emphasize that it's imperative that you keep this appointment.
How bad is it? He asks before he can stop himself.
I don't have any information on your case,
Marley tells him,
but I'd say that you should get going on what's wrong as soon as possible, don't you think so?
I do, Hodges says heavily. I'll keep the appointment for sure, and thank you. He breaks the connection and stares at his phone. On the screen is a picture of his daughter at 7, bright and smiling, riding high on the backyard swing he put up when they lived on Freeborn Avenue, when they were still a family. Now Allie's 36, divorced, in therapy and getting over a painful relationship with a man who told her a story as old as Genesis. I'm going to leave her soon, but this is a bad time. Hodges puts the phone down and lifts his shirt. The pain on the left side of his abdomen has subsided to a low mutter again, and that's good, but he doesn't like the swelling he sees below his sternum. It's as if he just put away a huge meal when, in fact, he could only eat half his lunch and breakfast was a bagel. What's going on with you? He asks his swollen stomach. I wouldn't mind a clue before I keep that appointment tomorrow. He supposes he could get all the clues he wants by firing up his computer and going to WebMD, but he's come to believe that internet-assisted self-diagnosis is a game for idiots. He calls Holly instead. She wants to know if he found anything interesting at 1588.
Very interesting, as that guy on Laugh-In used to say, but before I go into that, ask your question.
Do you think Pete can find out if Martine Stover was buying a computer? Check her credit cards or something? Because her mother's was ancient. If so, it means she was serious about taking an online course. And if she was serious, then...
Then the chances she was working up to a suicide pact with her mother dropped drastically.
Yes.
But it wouldn't rule out the mother deciding to do it on her own. She could have dumped the pills and vodka down Stover's feeding tube while she was asleep, then got into the tub to finish the job.
But Nancy Alderson said...
They were happy. Yeah, I know. I'm only pointing it out. I don't really believe it.
You sound tired.
Just my usual end-of-the-day slump. I'll perk up after I get some chow. Never in his life has he felt less like eating.
Eat a lot. You're too thin. But first, tell me what you found in that empty house.
Not in the house. In the garage. He tells her. She doesn't interrupt, nor does she say anything when he's done. Holly sometimes forgets she's on the phone, so he gives her a prompt. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I really don't. It's just weird all over. Don't you think so? Or not? Because I could be overreacting. Sometimes I do that.
Tell me about it, Hodges thinks, but this time he doesn't think she is and says so. Holly says,
You told me you didn't think Janice Ellerton would take anything from a man in amended parka and workman's clothes.
Indeed, I did.
So that means...
Now he's the one who stays silent, letting her work it out.
It means two men were up to something. Two. One gave Janice Ellerton the zappet and the bogus questionnaire while she was shopping, and the other watched her house from across the street. And with binoculars. Expensive binoculars. I guess those two men might not have been working together, but...
He waits, smiling a little. When Holly turns her thinking processes up to 10, he can almost hear the cog spinning behind her forehead.
Bill, are you still there?
Yeah, just waiting for you to spit it out.
Well, it seems like they must have been. To me, anyway. And like, they might have had something to do with those two women being dead. There. Are you happy?
Yes, Holly, I am. I've got a doctor's appointment tomorrow at 9:30.
Your test results came back?
Yeah. I want to set up a meeting beforehand with Pete and Isabel. Does 8:30 work for you?
Of course.
We'll lay out everything. Tell them about Alderson and the game console you found in the house at 1588. See what they think. Sound okay?
Yes, but she won't think anything.
You could be wrong.
Yes, and this guy could turn green with red polka dots tomorrow. Now go make yourself something to eat.
Hodges assures her he will, and heats up a can of chicken noodle soup while watching the early news. He eats most of it, spacing out each spoonful, cheering himself on. You can do it. You can do it. While he's rinsing the bowl,
The pain on the left side of his abdomen returns, along with those tentacles curling around to his lower back. It seems to plunge up and down with every heartbeat. His stomach clenches. He thinks of running to the bathroom, but it's too late. He leans over the sink instead, vomiting with his eyes closed. He keeps him that way as he fumbles for the faucet and turns it on full to rinse away the mess. He doesn't want to see what just came out of him, because he can taste a slime of blood in his mouth and throat. Oy, he thinks, I am in trouble here. I am in such trouble.
14. 8 p.m.
When her doorbell rings, Ruth Scapelli is watching some stupid reality program which is just an excuse to show young men and women running around in their small clothes. Instead of going directly to the door, she slipper scuffs into the kitchen and turns on the monitor for the security cam mounted on the porch. She lives in a safe neighborhood, but it doesn't pay to take chances. One of her late mother's favorite sayings was, "Scum travels." She is surprised and uneasy when she recognizes the man at her door. He's wearing a tweed overcoat, obviously expensive, and a trilby with a feather in the band. Beneath the hat, his perfectly barbered silver hair flows dramatically along his temples. In one hand is a slim briefcase. It's Dr. Felix Babineau, chief of the neurology department and head honcho at the Lakes Region Traumatic Brain Injury Clinic. The doorbell chimes again, and she hurries to let him in, thinking, he can't know about what I did this afternoon because the door was shut and no one saw me go in. Relax, it's something else, perhaps a union matter. But he has never discussed union matters with her before, although she's been an officer of Nurses United for the last 5 years. Dr. Babineau might not even know her if he passed her on the street unless she was wearing her nurse's uniform. That makes her remember what she's wearing now, an old house coat and even older slippers with bunny faces on them. But it's too late to do anything about that. At least her hair isn't up in rollers. He should have called, she thinks. But the thought that follows is disquieting. Maybe he wanted to catch me by surprise. Good evening, Dr. Babineau. Come in out of the cold. I'm sorry to be greeting you in my house coat, but I wasn't expecting company. He comes in and just stands there in the hall. She has to step around him to close the door. Seen up close instead of on the monitor, she thinks that perhaps they're even in the department of sartorial disarray. She's in her housecoat and slippers, true, but his cheeks are speckled with gray stubble. Dr. Babineau, no one would dream of calling him Dr. Felix, may be quite the fashion plate, witness the cashmere scarf fluffed up around his throat. But tonight he needs a shave, and quite badly. Also, there are purple pouches under his eyes. Let me take your coat, she says. He puts his briefcase between his shoes, unbuttons the overcoat, and hands it to her, along with the luxe scarf. He still hasn't said a single word. The lasagna she ate for supper, quite delicious at the time, seems to be sinking and pulling the pit of her stomach down with it. Would you like... Come into the living room, he says, and walks past her as if he owns the place. Ruth Scapelli scurries after. Babineau takes the remote control from the arm of her easy chair, points it at the television, and hits mute. The young men and women continue to run around, but they do so unaccompanied by the mindless patter of the announcer. Scapelli is no longer just uneasy. Now she's afraid. For her job, yes, the position she has worked so hard to attain, but also for herself. There's a look in his eyes that is really no look at all, only a kind of vacancy. Could I get you something? A soft drink or a cup of... Listen to me, Nurse Scapelli, and very closely if you want to keep your position.
I...
Nor would it end with losing your job. Babineau puts his briefcase on the seat of her easy chair and undoes the cunning gold clasps. They make little thudding sounds as they fly up.
You committed an act of assault on a mentally deficient patient today, what might be construed a sexual assault, and followed it with what the law calls criminal threatening.
I never...
She can barely hear herself.
She thinks she might faint if she doesn't sit down, but his briefcase is in her favorite chair. She makes her way across the living room to the sofa, barking her shin on the coffee table en route, almost hard enough to tip it over. She feels a thin trickle of blood sliding down to her ankle, but doesn't look at it. If she does that, she will faint.
You twisted Mr. Hartsfield's nipple. Then you threatened to do the same to his testes.
He made an obscene gesture to me, Scapelli bursts out. Showed me his middle finger.
I will see that you never work in the nursing profession again, he says, looking into the depths of his briefcase as she half swoons onto the sofa. His initials are monogrammed on the side of the case. In gold, of course. He drives a new BMW, and that haircut probably costs $50, maybe more. He's an overbearing, domineering boss, and now he's threatening to ruin her life over one small mistake, one small error in judgment. She wouldn't mind if the floor opened up and swallowed her, but her vision is perversely clear. She seems to see every filament on the feather poking out of his hatband, every scarlet thread in his bloodshot eyes, every ugly gray speck of stubble on his cheeks and chin. His hair would be that same rat fur color, she thinks, if he didn't dye it. Tears begin to come, hot tears running down her cold cheeks.
Please, Dr. Babineau.
She doesn't know how he knows, and it doesn't matter. The fact is, he does.
I'll never do it again. Please. Please.
Dr. Babineau doesn't bother to answer. 15. Selma Valdez, one of four nurses who worked the 3-to-11 shift in the bucket, gives a perfunctory rap on the door of 217. Perfunctory because the resident never answers and steps in. Brady is sitting in his chair by the window, looking out into the dark. His bedside lamp is on, showing the golden highlights in his hair. He is still wearing his button, reading, "I was shaved by Nurse Barbara." She starts to ask if he's ready for a little help in getting ready for bed. He can't unbutton his shirt or pants, but he is capable of shuffling out of them once that's accomplished, but then rethinks the idea. Dr. Babineau has added a note to Hartsfield's chart, one written in imperative red ink. Patient is not to be disturbed when in a semi-conscious state. During these periods, his brain may actually be rebooting itself in small but appreciable increments. Come back and check at half-hour intervals. Do not ignore this directive. Selma doesn't think Hartsfield is rebooting jack shit. He's just off in Gorkland. But like all the nurses who work in the bucket, she's a bit afraid of Babineau and knows he has a habit of showing up at any time, even in the small hours of the morning, and right now it's just gone 8 p.m. At some point since she last checked him, Hartsfield has managed to get up and take the 3 steps to his bedside table where his game gadget is kept. He doesn't have the manual dexterity needed to play any of the preloaded games, but he can turn it on. He enjoys holding it in his lap and looking at the demo screens. Sometimes he'll do it for an hour or more, bent over like a man studying for an important exam. His favorite is the fishing hole demo, and he's looking at it now. A little tune that she remembers from her childhood is playing. By the sea, by the beautiful sea. She approaches, thinks of saying, "You really like that one, don't you?" But remembers, "Do not ignore this directive," underlined, and looks down at the small 5 inches by 3 screen instead. She gets why he likes it. There's something beautiful and fascinating in the way the exotic fish appear, pause, and then zip away with a single flip of their tails. Some are red, some are blue, some are yellow. Oh, and there's a pretty pink one.
Stop looking!
Brady's voice grates like the hinges on a seldom-opened door, and while there is an appreciable space between the words, they are perfectly clear. Nothing at all like his usual mushy mumble. Selma jumps as if he goosed her instead of just speaking to her. On the Zap-It screen, there's a momentary flash of blue light that obliterates the fish, but then they're back. Selma glances down at the watch pinned upside down to her smock,
and sees it's now 8:20. Jesus, has she really been standing here for almost 20 minutes?
Go!
Brady is still looking down at the screen where the fish swim back and forth, back and forth. Selma drags her eyes away, but it's an effort.
Come back later.
Pause.
When I'm done.
Pause.
Looking.
Selma does as she's told, and once she's back in the hall, she feels like herself again. He spoke to her. Big whoop. And if he enjoys watching the fishing hole demo the way some guys enjoy watching girls in bikinis play volleyball, again, big whoop. The real question is why they let kids have those consoles. They can't be good for their immature brains, can they? On the other hand, kids play computer games all the time, so maybe they're immune. In the meantime, she has plenty to do. Let Hartsfield sit in his chair and look at his gizmo. After all, he's not hurting anybody. 16. Felix Babineau bends stiffly forward from the waist like an android in an old sci-fi movie. He reaches into his briefcase and brings out a flat pink gadget that looks like an e-reader. The screen is gray and blank.
There's a number in here I want you to find, he says. A 9-digit number. If you can find that number, Nurse Capelli, today's incident will remain between us.
The first thing that comes to mind is, you must be crazy. But she can't say that, not when he holds her whole life in his hands.
How can I? I don't know anything about those electronic gadgets. I can barely work my phone.
Nonsense. As a surgical nurse, you were in great demand because of your dexterity. True enough. But it's been 10 years since she worked in the Kiner surgical suites, handing out scissors and retractors and sponges. She was offered a 6-week course in microsurgery. The hospital would have paid 70%, but she had no interest. Or so she claimed. In truth, she was afraid of failing the course. He's right, though. In her prime, she had been fast. Babineau pushes a button on top of the gadget. She cranes her neck to see. It lights up, and the words, "Welcome to Zap It," appear. This is followed by a screen showing all sorts of icons. Games, she supposes. He swipes the screen once, twice, then tells her to stand next to him. When she hesitates, he smiles. Perhaps it's meant to be pleasant and inviting, but it terrifies her instead, because there's nothing in his eyes. No human expression at all. Come, nurse. I won't bite you. Of course not. Only what if he does? Nevertheless, she steps closer so she can see the screen where exotic fish are swimming back and forth. When they flick their tails, bubbles stream up. A vaguely familiar little tune plays. Do you see this one? It's called Fishin' Hole. Yes. Thinking. He really is crazy. He's had some sort of mental breakdown from overwork. If you were to tap the bottom of the screen, the game would come up and the music would change. But I don't want you to do that. The demo is all you need. Look for the pink fish. They don't come often and they're fast, so you have to watch carefully. You can't take your eyes off the screen.
Dr. Babineau, are you all right?
It's her voice, but it seems to be coming from far away. He makes no reply, just keeps looking at the screen. Scapelli is looking too. Those fish are interesting. And the little tune, that's sort of hypnotic. There's a flash of blue light from the screen. She blinks, and then the fish are back. Swimming to and fro, flicking their flippy tails and sending up burbles of bubbles. Each time you see a pink fish, tap it and a number will come up. 9 pink fish, 9 numbers. Then you will be done and all this will be behind us. Do you understand? She thinks of asking him if she's supposed to write the numbers down or just remember them, but that seems too hard, so she just says yes.
Good, he hands her the gadget. 9 fish, 9 numbers, but just the pink ones, mind.
Scapelli stares at the screen where the fish swim, red and green and blue and yellow. They swim off the left side of the little rectangular screen, then back on at the right. They swim off the right side of the screen, then back on at the left. Left, right, left. Some high, some low. But where are the pink ones? She needs to tap the pink ones. And when she's tapped 9 of them, all of this will be behind her. From the corner of one eye, she sees Babineau refastening the clasps on his briefcase. He picks it up and leaves the room. He's going. It doesn't matter. She has to tap the pink fish, and then all of this will be behind her. A flash of blue light from the screen, and then the fish are back. They swim left to right, and right to left. The tune plays. By the sea, by the beautiful sea, you and me, oh, how happy we'll be. A pink one. She taps it. The number 11 appears. 8 more to go. She taps a second pink fish as the front door quietly closes, and a third as Dr. Babineau's car starts outside. She stands in the middle of her living room, lips parted as if for a kiss, staring down at the screen. Colors shift and move on her cheeks and forehead. Her eyes are wide and unblinking. A fourth pink fish swims into view, this one moving slowly as if inviting the tap of her finger, but she only stands there. Hello, Nurse Scapelli. She looks up to see Brady Hartsfield sitting in her easy chair. He's shimmering a bit at the edges. Ghostly, but it's him all right. He's wearing what he was wearing when she visited him in his room that afternoon. Jeans and a checked shirt. On the shirt is that button reading, I was shaved by Nurse Barbara. But the vacant gaze everyone in the bucket has grown used to is gone. He's looking at her with lively interest. She remembers her brother looking at his aunt farm that way when they were children back in Hershey, Pennsylvania. He must be a ghost, because fish are swimming in his eyes. You'll tell, Hartsfield says, and it won't just be his word against yours. Don't get that idea. He had a nanny cam planted in my room so he can watch me, study me. It's got a wide-angle lens so he can see the whole room. That kind of lens is called a fisheye. He smiles to show he's made a pun. A red fish swims across his right eye, disappears, and then appears in his left one. Scapelli thinks, his brain is full of fish. I'm seeing his thoughts. The camera is hooked up to a recorder. He'll show the board of directors the footage of you torturing me. It didn't actually hurt that much. I don't feel pain the way I used to. But torture is what he'll call it. It won't end there either. He'll put it on YouTube. And Facebook, and badmedicine.com. It will go viral. You'll be famous. The torturing nurse. And who will come to your defense? Who will stand up for you? No one. Because nobody likes you. They think you're awful. And what do you think? Do you think you're awful? Now that the idea has been brought fully to her attention, she supposes she is. Anyone who would threaten to twist the testicles of a brain-damaged man must be awful. What was she thinking? Say it. He leans forward, smiling. The fish swim. The blue light flashes. The tune plays. Say it, you worthless bitch. I'm awful, Ruth Scapelli says in her living room, which is empty except for her. She stares down at the screen of the Zapit commander. Now, say it like you mean it. I'm awful. I'm an awful, worthless bitch.
And what is Dr. Babineau going to do?
Put it on YouTube? Put it on Facebook? Put it on badmedicine.com? Tell everyone?
You'll be arrested.
I'll be arrested.
They'll put your picture in the paper.
Of course they will.
You'll go to jail.
I'll go to jail.
Who will stand up for you?
No one.